I don't enjoy going to Walmart for this very reason. The lights spit and hiss sometimes due to their transformers, and I worry that the ceiling will collapse on me. Even now, I can't speak without glancing up at the ceiling every few moments. "I'd like to call my mother now," I say to the officer.
"Well, I'd like a winning lottery ticket, but something tells me neither of us is going to get what we want."
"I can't stay here," I tell him. He's still typing on his computer.
"I don't remember asking for your opinion."
Is this man particularly thick-headed? Or is he trying to annoy me? "I'm a student," I explain, the same way I might explain mass spectrometry to someone who doesn't have a clue about trace evidence analysis. "I have to be at school by 7:47 in the morning, or else I won't have time to get to my locker before class."
"Consider yourself on winter break," the officer says.
"Winter break isn't until February 15th. He punches a button on the keyboard.
"All right, stand up," he says.
So I do.
"What's in your pockets?"
I glance down at my jacket. My hands.
"So, you're a wise ass," the officer says. "Empty them. Come on."
Confused, I hold my palms up in front of me. There's nothing in them.
"Your pockets."
I pull out a stick of gum, a green pebble, a piece of sea glass, a strip of photographs of my mother and me, and my wallet. He takes them all. "Hey!"
"The money will be logged into your account," he says.
I watch him write notes on a piece of paper, and then he opens my wallet and takes out my money and my picture of Dr. Henry Lee. He starts to count the money, and by accident, he drops the pile. When he gathers it back up, it's out of order. Sweat breaks out on my forehead. "The money," I say.
"I didn't take any, if that's what you're worried about."
I see a 20 rubbing up against a dollar bill, and the $5 bill is backward, with President Lincoln face down. In my wallet, I make sure that everything is in order from the smallest denomination to the biggest, and everything faces up. I have never taken cash out of my mother's wallet without her permission, but sometimes, when she's unaware, I sneak into her purse and organize her money for her. I just don't like the thought of all that chaos. The coin pocket is already haphazard enough.
"You okay?"
the officer says, and I realize he's staring at me. "Could you?" I can barely speak, my throat has gotten so tight. "Could you just put the bills in order?"
"What the hell?"
With my hand curled to my chest, I point a single finger at the stack of bills. "Please," I whisper. "The ones go on top." If at least the money looks the way it is supposed to, that's something that hasn't changed.
"I don't believe this," the officer mutters,
but he does it. And once that 20 is resting safely at the bottom of the pile, I let out the breath I've been holding. "Thanks," I say, even though I noticed at least two of the bills are still upside down. "Jacob," I tell myself, "you can do this. It doesn't matter if you're in another bed tonight instead of your own. It doesn't matter if they don't let you brush your teeth. In the grand scheme of things, the world will not stop spinning." That is a sentence my mother likes to use when I get nervous about a change in routine. Meanwhile, the officer leads me to another room, one not much bigger than a closet.
"Strip,"
he says, and he folds his arms.
"Strip what?"
I answer.
"All of it. Underwear, too."
When I realize he wants me to take off my clothes, I'm so surprised that my jaw drops. "I'm not changing in front of you," I say, incredulous. "I won't even change for gym class in the locker room. I have a doctor's note from Dr. Moon saying that I don't have to, that I can participate in class while wearing my normal clothes. Again, the officer says, I didn't ask you. On television, I've seen inmates wearing jumpsuits, although I never really gave much thought to what happened to their clothes. But what I'm remembering now is bad. Very bad, with capital letters. On television, the jumpsuits are always orange. Sometimes it's enough to make me change the channel. I can feel my pulse accelerate at the thought of all that orange touching my skin. Of the other inmates wearing the same color. We would be like an ocean of hazard warnings, a sea of danger.
If you don't take off your clothes, the officer says, I will do it for you.
I turn my back to him and peel off my coat. I pull my shirt over my head. My skin is white, like a fish belly, and I don't have rippling stomach muscles like the Abercrombie and Fitch guys. This embarrasses me. I unzip my jeans and pull down my underwear, and then remember my socks. Then I crouch into a ball and carefully organize my clothes so that the olive khaki pants are on the bottom, then the green shirt, finally the green boxers and socks. The officer takes the clothes and starts shaking them out.
Hands out at your sides, he says,
and I close my eyes and do what he says, even when he makes me turn around and bend down, and I can feel his fingers moving me apart. A soft cloth sack hits my chest.
Get dressed again.
Inside it is clothing, but not my own. Instead, there are three pairs of socks, three pairs of underwear, three t-shirts, thermal pants, a thermal top, three pairs of dark blue pants and matching shirts, rubber flip-flops, a jacket, a hat, gloves, a towel. This is a huge relief. I won't be wearing orange after all. I've been to one sleepover in my life. It was at the home of a boy named Marshall, who has since moved to San Francisco. Marshall had a lazy eye and was, like me, often the butt of classmates' jokes in second grade. Our mothers were the ones who organized the sleepover, after mine learned that Marshall could spell the names of most dinosaurs from the Cretaceous period as well. My mother and I talked for 2 whole weeks about what would happen if I woke up in the middle of the night and wanted to come home. I'd call. What would happen if Marshall's mother served something for breakfast that I didn't like? I would say, no thank you. We talked about how Marshall might not have his clothes organized in his closet the way I do, and how he had a dog, and dogs sometimes drop hair on the floor without intending to. The night of the sleepover, my mother dropped me off after dinner. Marshall asked if I wanted to watch Jurassic Park, and I said yes. But when I started telling him during the video what was anachronistic and what was downright fictionalized, he got angry and told me to shut up, and I went to play with his dog instead. The dog was a Yorkshire Terrier, with a pink bow in its hair, even though it happened to be male. It had a very small pink tongue, and it licked my hand, which I thought I would like, but which I wanted to wash off immediately. That night, when we went to sleep, Marshall's mother put a rolled-up blanket between us to divide up his full-sized bed. She kissed him on the forehead, and then she kissed me, which was strange because she was not my mother. Marshall told me that in the morning, if we got up early, we could watch TV before his mother got up and caught us. Then he fell asleep, but I didn't. I was awake when the dog came into the room and burrowed underneath the covers, scratching me with its tiny black toenails. And I was still awake when Marshall wet the bed in his sleep, too. I got up and called my mother. It was 4:24 a.m. When she arrived, she knocked on the door, and Marshall's mother answered it in her bathrobe. My mother thanked her on my behalf.
I guess Jacob's an early riser, she said. Very early.
She tried to laugh a little, but it sounded like a brick falling. When we got into the car, she said, I'm sorry. Even though I didn't meet her gaze, I could feel her looking at me. Don't ever do that to me again, I answered. I have to fill out a form for visitors. I can't imagine who might want to come, so I write down my mother's name, and my brother's name, and our address, and their birth dates. I add Jess's name, too, although I know she can't visit, obviously, but I bet she would have wanted to. Then a nurse examines me, taking my temperature and checking my pulse just like at the doctor's office. When she asks me if I'm on any medication, I tell her yes. But she gets angry when I don't know the names of the supplements, when I can only tell her the colors or the fact that it comes in a syringe. Finally, I'm taken to the place where I will be staying. The officer walks me down a hallway until we reach a booth. Inside, another officer pushes a button, and the metal door in front of us slides open. I'm given another laundry bag, this one with two sheets and two blankets and a pillowcase. The cells are on the left side of a hallway that has a metal grate instead of a floor. Each cell has two beds, a sink, a toilet, and a television inside it. Each cell also has two men inside. They look like the same people you would see on the street, except, of course, they've all done something bad. Well, maybe not. After all, I'm here too.
You'll stay here for a week while you're evaluated, the officer says. Based on your behavior, you might be moved to the minimum security population.
He nods at one cell, which, unlike the other, has a smaller window.
That's the shower, the officer says.
How am I supposed to make sure I shower first when there are so many other people around? How am I going to brush my teeth when I don't have my toothbrush with me? How will I take my shot in the morning and my supplements? As I think about these details, I feel myself starting to lose control. It's not like a tsunami, although I'm sure that's what it looks like to someone on the outside. It's more like a packet of mail that's wrapped tight several times with a rubber band. When it snaps, the band stays in place, out of habit, or out of muscle memory, I don't know. And then one tiny move of the packet, and it begins to unravel. Before you know it, there's nothing holding that packet of letters together. My hand starts moving a little. My fingers playing a beat on my thigh. Jess is dead, and I am in jail, and I missed Crime Busters today, and my right eye has a tick now that I can't stop. We stop walking when we reach the cell at the end of the hallway.
Home sweet home, the officer says.
He unlocks the door to the cell and waits for me to move inside. The minute he locks the door again, I grab the bars. I can hear the lights buzzing overhead. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid didn't go to jail. Instead, they jumped off a cliff.
Kid, the next time I say let's go someplace like Bolivia, I mutter, let's go someplace like Bolivia.
My head hurts, and out of the corners of my eyes, I'm seeing red. I shut them, but the sounds are still there and my hands feel too big for my body and my skin is getting tighter. I picture it stretching so hard that it splits.
Don't worry, a voice says. You'll get used to it.
I spin around and hold my hands clutched in front of my chest, the way I used to walk sometimes when I wasn't concentrating on looking like everyone else. I assume the officer had put me in a special cell for people who have to be in jail but shouldn't really be. I hadn't realized that I, like everyone else, would have a roommate. He is wearing all his blue clothes plus his jacket and hat, pulled down to his eyebrows.
What's your name?
I stare at his face without looking him in the eye. He has a mole on his left cheek, and I've never liked people with moles.
I am Spartacus.
No shit. Then I hope you're in here for killing your parents.
He gets up from the bunk and walks behind me.
How about I call you bitch instead?
My hands grip the bars more tightly.
Let's get some things straight so that you and me, we get along. I get the bottom bunk. I get to go out to the exercise yard before you do. I pick the TV channel. You don't fuck with me, and I won't fuck with you.
There is a common behavior in dogs that are put together in close quarters. One will snap at the other until the beta dog knows that the alpha dog is to be obeyed. I am not a dog. Neither is this man. He's shorter than I am. The mole on his cheek is raised and shaped like a beehive. If Dr. Moon were here, she'd ask, "What's the number?"
16.
On a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the highest, my anxiety level is a 16, which is the worst number because it's A, even, B, has an even square root, and C, its even square root has an even square root. If my mother were here, she'd start singing "I Shot the Sheriff." I stick my fingers in my ears so I can't hear him, and I close my eyes so I can't see him, and I start to repeat the chorus without any breaks between the words, just a ribbon of sound that I can imagine circling me like a force field. Suddenly, he grabs my shoulder.
"Hey!"
he says, and I start to scream. His hat has fallen off so that I can see he is a redhead, and everyone knows that people with red hair don't really have red hair. They have orange hair. And worse, his hair is long. It falls all around his face and his shoulders, and if he leans any closer, it might land on me. The sounds that I make are high and piercing, louder than the voices of everyone who is telling me to shut the fuck up, louder than the officer who tells me he'll write me up if I don't stop. But I can't, because by now the sound is oozing out of all my pores, and even when I press my lips together, my body is screaming. I grab the bars of the cell door. Contusions are caused by blood vessels that are broken as the result of the blow, and smack my head against them. Cerebral contusion associated with subdural hematoma in the front lobe is associated with mortality. And again, each red blood cell is 1/3 hemoglobin. And then, just as I predicted, my skin cannot contain what's happening inside me, and it splits, and the blood runs down my face and into my eyes and mouth. I hear,
"Get this fucking nutcase out of my house!"
And,
"If he's got AIDS, I'm gonna sue this state for everything it's got!"
My blood tastes like pennies, like copper, like iron. Blood makes up 7% of the total body weight.
"On the count of three," I hear.
Two people grab my arms and I'm moving. But my feet don't feel like they belong to me, and it's too yellow under the lights, and there's metal in my mouth and metal on my wrists, and then I don't see or hear or taste anything at all. I think I might be dead. I make this deduction from the following facts. 1. The room that I'm in is monochromatic. Floor, walls, ceiling, all the color of pale flesh. 2. The room is soft. When I walk, it feels like walking on a tongue. When I lean against the walls, they lean against me too. I can't reach the ceiling, but it stands to reason it's the same. There's one door without any windows or a knob. 3. There's no noise except for my breathing. 4. There's no furniture, just a mat, which is flesh-colored too, and soft. 5. There's a grate in the middle of the floor, but when I look down inside it, I can't see anything. Maybe that's the tunnel that leads back to Earth. Then again, there are other factors that lead me to believe that I might not actually be dead after all. 1. If I were dead, why would I be breathing? 2. Shouldn't there be other dead people around? 3. Dead people don't have fierce headaches, do they? 4. Heaven probably doesn't have a door, knob notwithstanding. I touch my hand to my scalp and find a bandage shaped like a butterfly. There's blood on my shirt that is dried brown and stiff. My eyes are swollen, and there are tiny cuts on my hands. I walk around the grate, giving it a wide berth. Then I lie down on the mat with my arms crossed over my chest. This is what my grandfather looked like in his coffin. This is not how Jess looked. Maybe she's what's inside that grate. Maybe she's on the other side of that door. Would she be happy to see me? Or angry? Would I look at her and be able to tell the difference? I wish I could cry, like other humans do.
This ends Disc 7. House Rules, Disc 8. Emma. Jacob's medicines and supplements fill 2-gallon-sized Ziploc bags. Some are prescription, anti-anxiety meds given by Dr. Murano, for example, and others, like the glutathione, I get online for him. I'm waiting outside the visitor's entrance of the jail, holding these, when the door is unlocked. My mother used to tell me how, when she was a little girl, her appendix burst. That was back in the day before parents were allowed to stay with their children during hospitalizations, and so my grandmother would arrive 4 hours before visiting hours began and would stand at the front of a roped-off queue that my mother could see from her hospital bed. My grandmother would just stand there, smiling and waving, until they let her in. If Jacob knows I'm waiting for him, if he knows that I will see him every day at 9 o'clock, well, that's a routine he can cling to. I would have expected there to be more people waiting with me for the front door to open, but maybe for the rest of the mothers who have come to jail to visit their sons, this is old hat. Maybe they're used to the routine. There's only one other person waiting with me, a man dressed in a suit and carrying a briefcase. He must be a lawyer. He stamps his feet. "Cold out," he says, smiling tightly. I smile back. "It is." He must be a defense attorney, coming in here to see his client. "Do you, know how this works?" "Oh, first time?" he says. "It's a piece of cake. You go in, give up your license, and go through the metal detectors. Kind of like checking in for a flight." "Except you don't go anywhere," I muse. He glances at me and laughs. "That's for damn sure." A correctional officer appears on the other side of the glass door and turns the lock. "Hey, Joe," the lawyer says, and the officer grunts a greeting. "You see the Bruins last night?" "Yeah. Answer me this. How come the Patriots and the Sox can win championships, but the Bees are still skating like crap?" I follow them to a control booth, where the officer steps inside and the lawyer hands over his driver's license. The lawyer scribbles something on a clipboard and hands his keys to the officer. Then he walks through a metal detector, heading down a hall where I lose sight of him. "Can I help you, ma'am?" the officer asks. "Yes, I'm here to visit my son, Jacob Hunt." "Hunt?" He scans a list. "Oh, Hunt, right. He just came in last night."
"Yes."
"Well, you're not approved yet."
"For what?"
"Visitation. You'll probably be clear by Saturday. That's when visiting hours are anyway. Saturday? I repeat. You expect me to wait till Saturday?
Sorry, ma'am. Until you're cleared, I can't help you.
My son is autistic. He needs to see me. When his routine gets changed, he can get incredibly upset, even violent.
Guess it's a good thing he's behind bars, then, the officer says.
But he needs his medication. I lift the two Ziploc bags and set them on the lip of the counter.
Our medical staff can administer prescription meds, the officer says. I can get you a form to fill out for that.
There are dietary supplements, too, and he can't eat glutens or caseins.
Have his doctor contact the warden's office.
Jacob's diet and supplements, however, weren't mandated by a doctor. They were just tips, like 100 others, that mothers of autistic kids had learned over the years and had passed down to others in the same boat as something that might work. When Jacob breaks the diet, his behavior gets much worse.
Maybe we should put all our inmates on it then, the officer says. Look, I'm sorry, but if we don't get a doctor's note, we don't pass it along to the inmate.
Was it my fault that the medical community couldn't endorse treatments that autistic parents swore by? That money for autism research was spread so thin that even though many physicians would agree these supplements helped Jacob to focus or to take the edge off his hypersensitivity, they couldn't scientifically tell you why? If I'd waited for doctors and scientists to tell me conclusively how to help my son, he would still be locked in his own little world like he was when he was 3, unresponsive and isolated. Not unlike, I realize, a jail cell. Tears fill my eyes. I don't know what to do. I must look like I'm about to fall apart, because the officer's voice gets softer.
Your son have a lawyer?
He asks. I nod.
Might be a good place to start, he suggests.
From Auntie M's column. What I know now that I wish I'd known before I had kids. 1. If you stick a piece of bread in a VCR, it will not come out intact. 2. Garbage bags don't work as parachutes. 3. Childproofing is a relative term. 4. A tantrum is like a magnet. Eyes cannot help but lock onto you and your child when it happens. 5. Legos are not absorbed by the digestive tract. 6. Snow is a food group. 7. Kids know when you're not listening to them. 8. A Brussels sprout covered in cheese is still a Brussels sprout. 9. The best place to cry is in a mother's arms. 10. You'll never be as good a mother as you want to be. From my car, I call Oliver Bond. They won't let me see Jacob, I say. In the background, I can hear a dog bark.
Okay.
Okay? I can't see my son, and you think that's okay?
I meant okay, as in tell me more. Not okay, as in...
Just tell me what they said. I'm not on some approved visitors list, I shout. Do you think Jacob has any idea that he needs to tell the jail who can and cannot visit him?
Emma, the lawyer says, take a deep breath.
I can't take a deep breath. Jacob does not belong in jail.
I know. I'm sorry about that.
Don't be sorry, I snap. Be effective. Get me in to visit my son. He's quiet for a moment.
All right,
Oliver says finally.
Let me see what I can do.
I can't say it's a surprise to find Theo at home, but I am so mentally drained that I don't have the fortitude to ask him why he's here instead of at school. They wouldn't let me in to see Jacob, I say.
How come?
Instead of answering, I just shake my head. In the buttery light of late morning, I can see the softest down on Theo's cheek and jaw. It reminds me of the first time I noticed that Jacob was growing hair underneath his armpits, and I was unnerved. It was one thing to be needed so fiercely by a child. It was another thing to have to take care of a grown man.
Mom?
Theo says, hesitant.
Do you think he did it?
Without thinking, I slap him hard across the face. He falls back, reeling, his hand pressed to his cheek. Then he runs out the front door.
Theo!
I call after him. Theo! But he's already halfway down the block. I should follow him. I should apologize. I should confess that the reason I hit him wasn't what he said, but because he gave voice to all the unutterable thoughts I've been thinking. Do I believe Jacob is capable of murder? No. The easy answer, the knee-jerk reaction. This is my son we're talking about, the one who still asks me to tuck him in at night. But I also remember Jacob knocking over Theo's high chair when I told him he couldn't have another glass of chocolate soy milk. I remember the time he hugged a hamster to death. Mothers are supposed to be their children's biggest cheerleaders. Mothers are supposed to believe in their children no matter what. Mothers will lie to themselves, if necessary, to do this. I step outside and walk down the driveway in the direction Theo ran. Theo! I call. My voice doesn't sound like my own. I have clocked 193 miles today on my car, driving to Springfield and then back home and returning again. At 5:30, I'm again in the lobby of the jail visitor's entrance, with Oliver Bond standing beside me. He left a message on my cell phone instructing me to meet him here, explaining that he'd arranged a special visit for me while he sorted out long-term visiting plans. I was so happy to hear this that I didn't even dwell on the phrase long-term. At first, I hardly recognize Oliver. He isn't wearing a suit like he was yesterday. Instead, he's in jeans and a flannel shirt. This makes him seem even younger. I glance down at my own clothes, which look like something I'd wear to a staff meeting at the newspaper. What made me think I had to dress up for jail? Oliver leads me to the booth. Name? The officer asks. Emma Hunt? I say. He looks up. No, the name of the person you're here to visit? Jacob Hunt, Oliver interjects. We've arranged a special visit through the superintendent's office. The officer nods and hands me a clipboard to sign. He asks for my ID. Give him your keys, Oliver says. He'll hold them while you're inside. I pass them to the officer and then step toward the metal detector. Aren't you coming? Oliver shakes his head. I'll be waiting out here. A second officer arrives to lead me down the hall. Instead of turning into a room where there are tables and chairs set up, though, he leads me around the corner to a small cubicle. At first, I think it's a closet, but then I realize it's a visiting booth. A stool is pushed beneath a window that looks into a mirror image of this room. A handset is stuck to the wall. I think there's been a mistake, I say.
No mistake, the officer tells me. Non-contact visits only for inmates in protective custody.
He leaves me in the tiny chamber. Had Oliver known I wouldn't be able to see Jacob face to face? Had he not told me because he knew it would upset me? Or had he not been given this information? And what is protective custody? The door on the other side of the glass opens, and suddenly Jacob is there. The officer who's brought him points to the telephone on the wall, but Jacob has seen me through the glass. He presses his palms flat against it. He has blood on his shirt and in his hair. His forehead is covered with a line of purple bruises. His knuckles are scraped raw, and he's stimming like crazy. His hand twitching at his side like a small animal, his entire body bouncing on his toes. Oh, baby, I murmur. I point to the phone in my hand, and then to the spot where he should have a receiver too. He doesn't pick it up. He smacks his palms against the plexiglass that separates us. Pick up the phone, I cry, even though he can't hear me. Pick it up, Jacob. Instead, he closes his eyes. He sways forward and rests his cheek against the window, spreads his arms as wide as they can go. I realize he's trying to embrace me. I put the receiver down and step up to the window. I mimic his position so that we are mirrors of each other with a glass wall between us. Maybe this is what it's always like for Jacob, who tries to connect with people and can't ever quite manage it. Maybe the membrane between someone with Asperger's and the rest of the world isn't a shifting, invisible seam of electrons, but instead, a see-through partition that allows only the illusion of feeling instead of the actual thing. Jacob steps away from the window and sits on the stool. I pick up the phone, hoping he will follow my lead, but he isn't making eye contact. Eventually, he reaches for his receiver, and for a moment, I see some of the joy that used to spread across his face when he discovered something startling and came to share it with me. He turns the receiver over in his hands and then holds it to his ear. I saw these on Crime Busters, on the episode where the suspect turned out to be a cannibal. Hey, baby, I say, and I force myself to smile. He's rocking as he sits. His free hand, the one not holding the receiver, flutters as if he's playing an invisible piano. Who hurt you? He touches his fingers gingerly to his forehead. Mommy, can we go home now? I know precisely the last time Jacob called me that. It was after his middle school graduation when he was 14. He had received a diploma. Mommy, he had said, running up to show me. The other kids had heard him and they burst out laughing. Jacob, they teased. Your mommy's here to take you home. Too late, he had learned that. When you're 14, looking cool in front of your friends trumps unadulterated enthusiasm. Soon, I say, but the word comes out like a question. Jacob doesn't cry. He doesn't scream. He just lets the receiver drop from his hand, and then he puts his head down. I automatically reach toward him, and my hand smacks into the plexiglass. Jacob's head lifts a few inches and then falls. His forehead strikes the metal plate of the counter. Then he does it again. Jacob, don't! But of course, he can't hear me. His receiver dangles from its metal umbilicus where it fell when he let go. He keeps hitting his head over and over, I throw open the door to the visitation booth. The officer who brought me there is standing outside, leaning against the wall. "Help me," I cry. And he glances over my shoulder to see what Jacob's doing, then runs down the hallway to intervene. Through the window of the visitation booth, I watch him and a second officer grab Jacob by the arms and haul him away from the window. Jacob's mouth is twisted, but I can't tell if he's screaming or sobbing. His arms are pinned behind his back so that he can be handcuffed, and then one of the officers shoves him in the small of the back to propel him forward. This is my son, and they are treating him like a criminal. The officer returns a moment later to take me back to the jail lobby. "He's going to be fine," I'm told. "The nurse gave him a sedative." When Jacob was younger and more prone to tantrums, a doctor put him on clozapine, an antipsychotic. It got rid of his tantrums. It also got rid of his personality, period. I would find him sitting on the bedroom floor with one shoe on, the other still on the floor beside him, staring unresponsively at the wall. When he began to have seizures, we took him off the drug and never experimented with any others. I picture Jacob lying on his back on the floor of a cell, his pupils dilated and unfocused as he slips in and out of consciousness. As soon as I reach the lobby, Oliver approaches with a big smile on his face.
"How'd it go?"
he asks. I open my mouth and burst into tears. I fight for Jacob's IEPs, and I wrestle him to the ground when he goes ballistic in a public place. I have carved a life out of doing what needs to be done, because you can rail to the heavens, but in the end, when you're through, you will still be ankle deep in the same situation. I am the one who's strong, so that Jacob doesn't have to be. "Emma?" Oliver says. And I imagine he is as embarrassed as I am to find me sobbing in front of him. But to my surprise, he folds his arms around me and strokes my hair. Even more surprising, for a moment, I let him. This is what you can't explain to a mother who doesn't have an autistic child. Of course, I love my son. Of course, I would never want a life without him. But that doesn't mean that I'm not exhausted every minute of the day, that I don't worry about his future and my lack of one, that sometimes, before I can catch myself, I imagine what my life would have been like if Jacob did not have Asperger's. That, like Atlas, I think just for once it would be nice to have someone else bear the weight of my family's world on his shoulders, instead of me. For 5 seconds, Oliver Bond becomes that person. "I'm sorry," I say, pushing away from him. "I got your shirt all wet."
"Yeah, Woolrich flannel is really delicate. I'll add the dry cleaning bill to the retainer."
He approaches the control booth and retrieves my license and keys, then leads me outside.
"Now, what happened in there?"
"Jacob hurt himself. He must have been smacking his head against something. His forehead is completely bruised, and there were bandages and blood all over his scalp. He started to do it again just now in the visitation booth, and they gave him a tranquilizer. They won't give him his supplements, and I don't know what he's eating or if he's eating at all, and..." I break off, meeting his gaze. "You don't have children, do you?" He blushes.
"Me? Kids? No.
"I watched my son slip away once, Oliver. I fought too hard to bring him back to let him go again. If Jacob is competent to stand trial, he won't be after 2 weeks of this. Please, I beg. Can't you do anything to get him out?" Oliver looks at me. In the cold, his breath takes shape between us.
No, he says. But I think you can.
Jacob. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, and so on. This is the Fibonacci sequence. It can be defined explicitly. A of n equals 5 plus root 5 over 10 times 1 plus root 5 over 2, all to the power of n, plus 5 minus root 5 over 10 times 1 minus root 5 over 2, all to the power of n. It can be defined recursively, too. A sub 0 equals 1. A sub 1 equals 1. A sub n equals a sub n minus 2 plus a sub n minus 1. This means that it's an equation based on its previous values. I'm forcing myself to think in numbers because no one seems to understand what I say when I speak English. It's like a Twilight Zone episode where words suddenly have changed their meaning. I say stop, and it keeps going. I ask to leave, and they lock me up tighter. This leads me to two conclusions. One, I'm being punked. However, I don't think my mother would have let the joke go on for quite this long, which leads me to two. No matter what I say, no matter how clearly I say it, no one understands me. Which means I must find a better method of communication. Numbers are universal, a language that transcends countries and time. This is a test. If someone, just one person, can understand me, then there's hope that he'll understand what happened at Jess's house, too. You can see Fibonacci numbers in the flowering of an artichoke or the scales of a pine cone. You can use their sequence to explain how rabbits reproduce. As n approaches infinity, the ratio of a of n to a of n minus 1 approaches phi, the golden ratio, 1.618033989, which was used to build the Parthenon and appears in compositions by Bartok and Debussy. I'm walking, and with every step I let another number in the Fibonacci sequence come into my head. I move in smaller and smaller circles to the middle of the room, and when I get there, I start over. 1, 1, 2, 3, 5, 8, 13, 21, 34, 55, 89, 144. An officer comes in carrying a tray. Behind him is a nurse. Hey, kid, he says, waving his hand in front of me. Say something. 1, I reply. Huh? 1. 1 what? 2, I say. It's dinner time, the officer tells me. 3. You gonna eat this or throw it again? 5. I think it's pudding tonight, the officer says, pulling the cover off the tray. 8. He inhales deeply. Yum. 13. Finally, he gives up. I told you, it's like he's on a different planet. 21, I say. The nurse shrugs and lifts up a needle. Blackjack, she says, and she plunges the syringe into my bottom while the officer holds me still. After they're gone, I lie on the floor, and with my finger, I write the exponential equation of the Fibonacci sequence in the air. I do this until it gets blurry, until my finger is as heavy as a brick. The last thing I remember thinking before I disappear is that numbers make sense. You can't say the same about people.
Oliver. The Vermont Public Defender's Office is not called the Public Defender's Office, but rather something that sounds like it was ripped from the pages of a Dickens novel. The Office of the Defender General. However, like in all public defender's offices, the staff is overworked and underpaid, which is why, after I send Emma Hunt off with her own homework, I head to my apartment office to complete my own. Thor greets me by jumping up and nailing me right in the groin. "Thanks, buddy," I wheeze, and I brush him off. He's hungry, though, so I feed him leftover pasta mixed with kibble while I look up the information I need on the internet and make a phone call. Although it's 7 p.m., long past office hours, a woman picks up. "Hi there," I say. "My name's Oliver Bond. I'm a new attorney in Townsend." "We're closed now." "I know, but I'm a friend of Janice Roth, and I'm trying to track her down." "She doesn't work here anymore." I know this. In fact, I also know that Janice Roth recently got married to a guy named Howard Wirtz, and that they moved to Texas, where he had a job waiting with NASA. Public record searches are the best friend of the defense attorney. "Oh, shoot, really? That's a bummer. I'm a friend of hers from law school." "She got married," the woman says. "Yeah, to Howard, right? Did you know him?" "No, but I know she was crazy about him," I say. "By any chance, are you a defender general, too?" "Sadly, yes," she sighs. "You're in private practice? Believe me, you're not missing out." "Nah, you'll get into heaven long before me," I laugh. "Look, I have a really quick question. I'm new to practicing criminal law in Vermont, and I'm still learning the ropes." I'm new to practicing criminal law, period, but I don't tell her that. "Sure, what's up?" "My client's a kid, 18, and he's autistic. He sort of flipped out in court during the arraignment, and now he's locked up until his competency hearing, but he can't adapt to jail. He keeps trying to hurt himself. Is there any way to speed up the wheels of justice here?" "Vermont's decidedly crappy when it comes to psychiatric care for inmates. They used to use the state hospital as a lockup for competency exams, but it lost its funding, so now Springfield gets most of the cases, since they've got the best medical care," she says. "I once had a client being held pending competency who liked to slick himself head to toe. He did it the first night with a 1-pound block of butter at dinner, and with deodorant before a visit with me." "A contact visit?" "Yeah, the officers didn't care. I guess they thought the worst he could do is rub me down with something. Anyway, with that guy, I filed a motion to set bail," the attorney says. "That gets you back in front of the judge. Put his shrink or counselor on the stand to back up your story, but waive your client's appearance because you don't want a repeat performance in the courtroom that will piss off the judge. Your main job is to convince the judge he's not a danger if he's not locked up, and if he's running around like a lunatic in court, that sort of messes up your case." "Motion to set bail," I write down on a pad in front of me. "Thanks," I say. "That's awesome." "No problem. Hey, you want Janice's email?" "Absolutely," I lie. She reads it to me and I pretend to write it down. When I hang up, I go to the fridge and pull out a bottle of Poland Spring. I pour half into Thor's bowl and then raise the bottle in a toast. "To Janice and Howard," I say. "Mr. Bond," Judge Cuttings says the next day, "aren't we waiting for our competency evaluation in this case?" "Your Honor," I reply, "I don't think we can." The courtroom is empty, with the exception of Emma, Dr. Morano, and the prosecutor, a woman named Helen Sharp, who has very short red hair and pointed canine teeth that make me think of a vampire or a pit bull. The judge looks at her. "Miss Sharp, what are your feelings?"
"I don't know anything about this case, Judge," she says. "I literally got notice of this hearing this morning. The defendant is charged with murder. You ordered a competency hearing. It's the state's position that he remain locked up until then." "With all due respect, Your Honor," I reply, "I think the court should listen to my client's mother and psychiatrist." The judge waves me on, and with a gesture, I motion Emma to come forward to the witness stand. She has dark shadows beneath her eyes, and her hands are shaking. I watch her move them from the railing to her lap so that the judge cannot see.
"Please state your name and address," I say.
"Emma Hunt, 132 Bird's Eye Lane in Townsend? Is Jacob Hunt, the defendant in this case, your son? Yes, he is. Can you tell us how old Jacob is? Emma clears her throat. He turned 18 in December. Where does he live? With me, in Townsend. Is he in school? I ask. He goes to Townsend Regional High School. He's a senior. I look directly at her. Ms. Hunt, does Jacob have any particular medical condition that makes you concerned for his safety while he's in jail? Yes. Jacob's been diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome. It's high-functioning autism. How does Asperger's affect Jacob's behavior? She pauses for a moment, glancing down. When he decides to do something, he needs to do it immediately, Emma says. If he can't, he gets very agitated. He hardly ever shows emotion, either happy or sad, and he can't relate to the conversations of kids his own age. He takes words very, very literally. If you asked him to eat with his mouth closed, for example, he'd tell you that's impossible. He has hypersensitivity issues. Bright lights, loud noises, and light touches set him off. He doesn't like being the center of attention. He needs to know exactly when something is going to happen, and if his routine gets disrupted, he becomes extremely anxious and acts in a way that makes him stand out even more. Flapping his hands at his sides, or talking to himself, or repeating movie lines over and over. When things are really overwhelming, he'll go somewhere to hide, his closet or under his bed, and he'll stop speaking.
Okay, says Judge Cuttings. So your son is moody, literal, and wants to do things his way and on his own timetable. That sounds very much like a teenager.
Emma shakes her head. I'm not explaining this well. It's more than just being literal or wanting a routine. An ordinary teenager decides not to interact. For Jacob, it's not a choice. What sorts of changes have you seen since your son's incarceration? I ask. Emma's eyes fill with tears. He's not Jacob, she says. He's hurting himself on purpose. He's regressing in his speech. He started stimming again, flapping his hands, bouncing on his toes, walking in circles. I've spent 15 years trying to make Jacob a part of this world instead of allowing him to isolate himself, and a single day in that jail reversed everything. She looks at the judge. I just want my son to come back before it's too late to reach him. Thank you, I say. Nothing further. Helen Sharp stands up. She is easily 6 feet tall. Did I not notice that when she walked in? Your son, has he ever been incarcerated before? No, Emma answers. Has he ever been arrested before? No. Are there other times you've witnessed a backslide in your son's behavior? Yes, Emma says. When plans change at the last minute, or when he's upset and can't verbalize that? Then isn't it possible that his current behavior has nothing to do with incarceration and everything to do with him feeling guilty for committing a horrific crime? Heat floods Emma's face. He would never do what you've accused him of doing. Maybe, ma'am, but at this point your son's been charged with first-degree murder. You understand that, don't you? Yes, Emma says tightly. And your son has been placed in protective custody, so his safety isn't at issue. If his safety wasn't at issue, would he have to be in a padded cell in the first place? Emma retorts, and I want to run up there and give her a high five. Nothing further, the prosecutor says. I stand up again. The defense calls Dr. Moon Murano. Jacob's psychiatrist's name may sound like that of someone who grew up on a commune, but that was her parents. She must have rebelled and joined the Young Republicans because she's turned up for court in a power suit, killer heels, and a bun so tight it is practically functioning as a facelift. I walk her through her credentials and then ask her how she knows Jacob. I've been working with him for 15 years, she says, in conjunction with his Asperger's diagnosis. Tell us a little about Asperger's, I say. Well, the syndrome was discovered by Dr. Hans Asperger in 1944, but it wasn't known in the English-speaking world until the late 1980s, and it wasn't classified as a psychiatric disorder until 1994. Technically, it's a neurobiological disorder that affects several areas of development. Unlike some other children on the autism spectrum, kids with Asperger's are very bright and verbal and crave social acceptance. They just don't know how to get it. Their conversations might be one-sided. They might be focused on a very narrow topic of interest. They might use repetitive language or a monotone voice. They won't be able to read social cues or body language, and therefore can't identify the feelings of people around them. Because of this, someone with Asperger's is often considered to be odd or eccentric, which leads to social isolation. Well, Doctor, there are a lot of folks in the world who are odd or eccentric and haven't been diagnosed with Asperger's, right? Of course. So, how do you diagnose it? It's theory of mind. The child who chooses privacy versus the child who can't connect but wants to, desperately, and cannot put himself in the shoes of another child to better understand how to facilitate that. She glances at the judge. Asperger's is a developmental disability, but it's a hidden one. Unlike, for example, a mentally challenged individual, a child with Asperger's might look normal and even sound fairly normal and appear incredibly competent, yet he will have crippling difficulties with communication and social interaction. Doctor, how often do you see Jacob? I ask. I used to see him weekly when he was younger, but now we're down to once a month. And he's a senior in public school? That's correct. So he doesn't have any educational delays due to his Asperger's? No, Dr. Morano says. As a matter of fact, Jacob's IQ is probably higher than yours, Mr. Bond. I don't doubt that, Helen Sharp murmurs. Does Jacob have any special accommodations at school? He has an individualized education plan, an IEP, which is mandated by law for children with disabilities. Ms. Hunt and I meet with the principal and Jacob's teachers 4 times a year to review strategies that will help him function well at school. What's normal to certain high school students would set Jacob off into a tailspin. Such as, commotion in a classroom is going to be very overwhelming for Jacob. Flashing lights, being touched, crumpled paper. Something that's unexpected in terms of sensation. Like darkness in preparation for a video or film is hard for Jacob if he doesn't know in advance that it's going to happen, Morano says. So his accommodations are meant to keep him from being overstimulated. Exactly. How's he doing in school this year? He got all A's and 1 B the first semester, Dr. Morano says. Before he was incarcerated, I ask, when was the last time you saw Jacob? 3 weeks ago, for a routine visit. How was Jacob doing? Very, very well, the psychiatrist says. In fact, I commented to Ms. Hunt that Jacob initiated a conversation with me instead of the other way around. And this morning? This morning, when I saw Jacob, I was appalled. I haven't seen him in a state like this since he was 3 years old. You need to understand, this is something chemical in his brain. Mercury poisoning of a sort, caused by vaccinations. Oh, crap. It's only the diligent biomedical treatment regimen and Emma Hunt's commitment to her son's social interaction that's brought Jacob to the point he was prior to incarceration. You know who really ought to be tossed in jail? The drug companies that are getting rich off the vaccinations that triggered a wave of autism in the 90s. Objection! I yell. Mr. Bond, the judge says, you can't object to your own witness. I smile, but it's really a grimace. Dr. Morano, thanks for your political opinion, but I don't think that's necessary right now. But it is. I'm seeing the same pattern. A sweet, interactive, social child has suddenly isolated himself, removing himself from stimuli, not interacting with people. We don't know enough about the autistic brain to understand what it is that brings these kids back to us, and why only some of them manage to return. But we do understand that a severely traumatic incident, like incarceration, can lead to a permanent regression. Do you have any reason to believe that if Jacob was released to the care of his mother, he'd be a danger to himself or others? Absolutely not, Dr. Morano says. He follows rules to the letter. In fact, that's an Asperger's trait. Thank you, Doctor, I finish. Helen Sharp taps her pen on the desk in front of her. Dr. Morano, you just referred to Jacob as a boy, didn't you? Yes, I suppose I did. Well, he's actually 18 years old. That's true? He's legally an adult, Helen says. He's responsible for his actions, isn't he? We all know there's a chasm between legal responsibility and emotional capacity. Does Jacob have a guardian? Helen asks. No, he has a mother. Has his mother applied to be his legal guardian? No, Dr. Morano says. Have you applied to be his legal guardian? Jacob only turned 18 a month ago. The prosecutor stands up. You said that it's very important to have Jacob adhere to a stable routine. It's critical, the psychiatrist says. Not knowing what's happening to him right now is likely what led to this breakdown. So Jacob needs to be able to predict his schedule in order to feel secure. That's right. Well, what if I were to tell you, Doctor, that in the Southern State Correctional Facility, Jacob will rise at the same time every day, will eat his meals at the same time every day, will shower at the same time every day, will go to the library at the same time every day, and so on. Why isn't that perfectly in line with what Jacob's accustomed to? Because it's not what he's accustomed to. It is such a deviation from his ordinary daily routine, such an unplanned break, that I worry it's irrevocably affected him. Helen smirks. But Dr. Morano, you do understand that Jacob's been charged with the murder of his social skills counselor.